91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we visit with University of Miami Professor of Philosophy and Psychology, Dr. Britt Brogard. She's co-author of the book, The Superhuman Mind, Free the Genius in Your Brain. Welcome to our program, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We'll discuss what makes geniuses, savants, and virtuosos, and whether ordinary people can attain super neurological feats as well. Sometimes a creative savant is created by a hard knock. The injured left brain may relinquish control of the creative right side. Some people see numbers as colors. Some actually feel the pain of others. And a few instantly become world-class painters. We'll come back with the professor after the news. Seven minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Interesting program today, Bonnie.
Indeed, it is. Have you ever wondered how someone can memorize six decks of cards or multiply outlandishly large numbers in their head?
Remember the movie Rain Man, where Dustin Hoffman plays an autistic man with rare mental abilities, including counting blackjack cards?
That's what we're talking about today. With us is University of Miami Philosophy and Psychology Professor Dr. Britt Brogard. We'll call her Britt.
And she studies these phenomena. She's co-authored a book about them and is herself a synesthete. We'll learn more about that in minutes.
The book is The Superhuman Mind, Free the Genius in Your Brain. So welcome, Britt.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So as Joe mentioned in his intro, you are a synesthete. So could you tell us in really lay terms what that is?
Synesthesia is a case where you have two sensory channels that combine in unusual ways. So you could have sound that you actually hear is colored, or you could have see numbers or letters in colors, even though they're printed in black. You might have pain in your tooth, and you actually sort of see or conceptualize your tooth as yellow. You might feel the pain of others. So you have these sensory stimuli that are combined in very unusual ways.
And how long have we known about this? Or how long has it been getting attention?
It's had a current attention since sometime in, well, by the end of 1900. It was not when it was discovered. It was discovered much earlier. There are multiple cases that have been described in the literature in the 1700 and 1800. And some people even say that there are references in Shakespeare and elsewhere to synesthesia. But it wasn't taken very seriously by many researchers because we didn't have the technology to investigate it in an objective way.
Now, what is your synesthete?
So my form of synesthesia is fear to color, shape, and texture, which means that when I feel intense fear, there's a certain landscape that has the very same color in between blue and green. It's rotating, and it has a certain texture, and there's some shapes in it. It's the very same projected image, and it's projected out in my visual field. And in some cases, it can block out my visual field, but it tends to be somewhat transparent, so that's why we talk about projection.
Now, is the vibrancy of the image you see, is that governed by how fearful you are?
Yes.
Is it more intense?
Yes, it definitely is.
Tell us how it saved your life, literally.
I was hiking in Australia, where I did my postdoc. I was in the rainforest hiking, and there were very poisonous snakes there, which we were told about. Some of these brown and black snakes, and you can actually die from a snake bite within 30 minutes. But we were also told how to avoid them, and mostly they would just be sunbathing on the little narrow track. But suddenly I was hiking along the track, and I had this landscape in front of me, and I was puzzled, because normally I experience a fear, and then if it's intense enough, I have this projection. But this time I just had the projection, I just had this landscape. And so I was wondering about this, and then I noticed that there was a rather poisonous snake close to me, so I was able to remove myself from that situation. So it seemed that who knows what would have happened, but at least it seems that it could have been a warning sign in that case.
What led you and your co-author to begin to write The Superhuman Mind, Free the Genius in Your Brain?
We began by looking at people with synesthesia, so people of the sorts that we've just been talking about. And then we noticed that some of them also had other unusual skills. And so they had extraordinary cognitive abilities. And so we began looking at people with that condition, which is called Savant syndrome. And we looked at people who trained themselves to become people with extraordinary talents. And we had more and more subjects coming in St. Louis. I was in St. Louis at the time. And we looked at them, talked to them, and did research on them. And then we thought, wow, this is quite amazing. There's sort of a connection between these people. And the connection seems to be synesthesia and Savant syndrome and related conditions. And maybe people can learn something about that. And maybe people can use some of the techniques that we learn from the subjects about how to improve your cognitive abilities, and maybe perhaps even learn to do something like what synesthetes do.
Can you be synesthetic and not know it?
You certainly can. I've met many people who think that everyone is like them. So one case, after I found out that my daughter had synesthesia,
that's with the color.
That's with the numbers, letters, two colors.
Call graphemes.
It's called, the numbers and letters are called graphemes, so we call it grapheme color synesthesia.
Okay.
I went back to my home country, Denmark, and I asked my mom in the kitchen, what's the color of the number 7? And blank stare. And she thought if something was wrong with me. And then my dad walked in and from outside, and I asked him, what's the color of the number 7? And blank stare. And he said, white, of course. Why are you asking? And so he had gone his whole life, or most of his life, without knowing that that was not completely common.
Similar to colorblindness.
Yeah, so a lot of people who are colorblind don't realize that they are colorblind.
How common is it, or uncommon?
All kinds of synesthesia taken together, it's about between 4 and 7% of the population.
Okay. It's always inherited?
It is when it's induced that way. It's normally inherited. It runs in families. You can also acquire it after brain injury, brain disease.
Right. And we want to talk more about that.
Yes, we will.
Yes. And through drugs, actually.
Through?
Drugs.
Oh, through drugs. You mean like LSD and...
Yeah. Yeah.
Psilocybin.
Yes.
You talk about those in the book.
Yes.
There's a test you can take?
There is a test. It's not going to work for all forms of synesthesia, but for the grapheme color synesthesia, which is a number letter synesthesia, it's an online test that's run by researchers. It's we call it a battery, which means it's actually a number of tests. And we can test people with that condition fairly accurately. When people have other conditions, we sometimes have to use brain scans to figure out whether there's some underlying objectivity to the condition.
So in your case, there was clearly an advantage. It was like a warning system to let you know that snake was there. So do you think that synesthesia has survived because it has advantages of its own, or
because it's genetic, it could be evolution. Then.
Yeah.
Yes. So there is at least hypothesis that it has had an advantage, that all of these have had advantages, all the different forms. For instance, people with the grapheme color synesthesia, many of them have improved memory, especially for numbers in that case. Some people are very creative when they have synesthesia. Some people become better at math. So it could have had that advantage to our ancestors, and so it could have been passed on that way. There are other possible explanations, but that's certainly one possible explanation.
So I asked you, does that mean you're always going to be a synesthete? And you said not necessarily.
Not necessarily. I know people who were synesthetes until they were 20 years old, and then they suddenly disappeared. It can disappear. It's fairly rare that it disappears when you have it from early childhood. But there are cases where people's synesthesia has either disappeared or faded or changed slightly over time.
That would be another example of the brain's plasticity?
Plasticity, yes. It certainly can happen because those connections that people have from birth, there are additional connections. They're connections that most people don't have. And they were not pruned away. By that we mean they were not sort of destroyed during development in the teen years. And it could be that later on something happens in the brain that makes the brain actually take away those connections.
Now, it can also be debilitating, can't it?
It can in some cases. One of our subjects has sound color synesthesia that is so extreme that when he is in a room with loud, really loud noise, his whole visual field fills with color, and so he is essentially legally blind. So that is obviously a problem. He has no problem, of course, if it's a quiet room. There are also people who are bothered by feeling other people's pain, depending on how intense it is. That can be a bothersome condition.
We're speaking with Britt Brogard. She PhD. She's a professor of philosophy with joint appointments in the departments of philosophy and psychology at the University of Miami. And she's also the author of The Superhuman Mind, Free the Genius in Your Brain, which she wrote with Christian Marlowe. We're going to take a short break on Topical Currents, and we'll be right back.
And we're back 20 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Dr. Britt Brogard about her book, The Superhuman Mind, which she co-wrote. Doctor, tell us more about instant savants, and usually a blow to the head begins it.
Yeah, we have many cases where people have a brain injury, and afterwards they develop either synesthesia or these extraordinary abilities that we call savant syndrome or savant skills, or both. We have some very interesting cases. A very recent case, it was a woman. She was a farmer, a very skilled farmer, in charge of a big farm with lots of farm animals, and that was her, not just her hobby, it was her job, it was her obsession. And it was in Colorado. She was feeding chickens, and she fell down the mountain and landed in a tree and had to be cut out of the tree. The tree actually saved her because she otherwise would have continued down the mountain. And a helicopter had to take her to a trauma hospital. She had a partial spinal fracture, and she recovered from that because it wasn't a full fracture. And afterwards, she realized that she had no interest in taking care of farm animals anymore. So she suddenly felt like she needed to draw, and she started drawing, and she started writing poetry, and that's what she does right now.
In fact, a lot of the savants that you talk about that come to your lab were not born that way. You say none of them were born that way. And that's interesting because we're talking about the synesthesia with which you are born. So these are all things that have happened to them in one way or another.
And like with someone suddenly becoming a concert pianist.
Yes.
Who never
yes.
touched a piano before.
Yes. So we have cases like that. Derek Amato is a case like that. He was playing ball with some friends around a pool, being a salesman and into sports. And he mistook the deep end for the shallow end and dove into the shallow end of the pool, hurt his head, and suddenly he just became interested in playing the piano. And after sleeping for 4 days after his concussion, he went to a friend's house and started playing the piano, and he's made several albums and traveled the world giving concerts since then.
Okay, I have a question. We think of traumatic brain injury, these TBIs, as very bad things. We hear so much about it in the NFL now, and, you know, people die from traumatic brain injuries. So what distinguishes between a good traumatic brain injury that makes you a concert pianist or a, you know, star, and a one that's so serious that causes this brain damage that can really be very, very bad for you?
And dementia.
Yeah.
That's a very good question, don't it, Bonnie? So we don't know, but we have some hypotheses, and we certainly don't encourage people to go out and
get brain injury.
Don't try this at home.
the wall. There seem to be two factors involved. One is the exact location where the brain injury takes place, which can actually then facilitate a change in other areas of the brain and increase people's talents, sort of dormant talents in those areas of the brain. There may also be individual differences between people. So some people might have brains that are more plastic in certain ways, in the ways that are required, than other people. So even if the two people are knocked or hit on the heads in exactly the same location, it may be that one person becomes a savant and the other person has disabilities afterwards. So those are the two most likely explanations, that you have to be hit in exactly the right spot in order for this to happen.
My. So, and you don't know when or...
Not yet.
No. But, and you don't know exactly where that is yet.
Not yet. We have some theories about what will happen. So people who develop synesthesia often have had injuries to the areas that are involved in the senses. So that could be areas that are involved in, say, vision, so the perceptual areas of the brain. People who develop autistic abilities, many of them seem to have had some damages to the upper left part of the brain, which is the control area, the rational area of the brain. That is actually a bit of a bussy area of the brain. So it's normally...
A bit of what?
It's bussy.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's bussy.
It's the bussy part.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's bussy part. it suppresses areas, your creativity, your artistic skills. And it does that for very good reasons, because sometimes different functions are not mutually compatible.
So you don't decide to paint the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah, so you might be more sort of driven towards more rational activities or less creative activities. And when you get damages to those areas, very, very often people become very creative, especially artistically. We have cases where, so there are two forms of dementia. So the form that's not Alzheimer's, but the other form, which is actually affecting the upper left part of the brain.
The frontotemporal dementia,
exactly.
You talk about?
Yes.
Okay.
And in so many of those cases, when that area is affected, people actually do take up some artistic skill, like painting or something like. So that's some kind of indicates that may be one mechanism.
I think our listeners would like to hear the story of Jason Padgett.
Oh yeah, I was going to ask.
Who was the student that was beaten with a baseball bat?
Yeah.
He described himself as a very poor student and a very kind of shallow guy, and suddenly.
Yeah, he was very shallow, and he was into girls and drinks and riding fast cars, and he was picking up a friend at a karaoke bar, and as he walked out from the bar, he was hit on the head, and he thought, oh, that had to be an accident. That couldn't be something really real. But then he was hit again, and he was kicked and hit, and he became temporarily unconscious, and he had to go to the hospital. He had a concussion. He was sent home to rest, and which is very common after a concussion. And then he immediately realized that he saw the world in different ways, in two different ways. So in one way, he saw the world in terms of geometrical figures. Some people would call them fractals, even though mathematicians have a slightly different notion of a fractal. But it was sort of fractalized, so the world was in bits and pieces. And he also was unable to see motion in a smooth fashion. So it would be motion like if you took an old video player and you pressed the pause button really fast, really, really many times. That's sort of what his motion...
Or like the old moon videos.
Yeah, right.
Or like a film. Like I think it's 18 frames per second or whatever it is that he would see each frame.
Yes, yes, yes. So you see each frame. And then after... He actually also had some post-traumatic stress disorder, so he went into hiding for a few years. When he came back out, he thought, well, I actually think that there's something, that these things I'm seeing have something to do with mathematics. And he started drawing these things he was seeing, and he used just a pencil and drew these amazing pictures. If you look up Jason Pageant online, you can see these amazing pictures that are all hand-drawn. And he went into community college. He picked up some math skills. He was a college dropout before that. Picked up some minimal, very basic math skills. And then he started understanding some mathematical formulas in terms of these images he was seeing. So he suddenly had some new insights, at least for him, new insights into mathematics. And he has also published his own book about that whole story.
And the artwork goes for thousands.
Yeah.
And was he the one that did the pie?
Yes.
He was drawing pie.
It all went back
3.14 whatever.
Yes, that's his main thing. That's his main thing, but he also does a lot of other stuff, but his pie stuff is his main thing.
So do savants and those with autistic spectrum disorder share many of the same brain characteristics?
That's what we think. So about 10% or possibly more of people with autism have savant skills. And it seems that at least one theory about autism is that one hemisphere, so that's one side of the brain, is affected in a negative way. But then that has been compensated for in the other side of the brain, the other hemisphere. So you're better in one hemisphere, but not as good in the other side of the brain. And so that's also what we see in people who acquire savant skills. And what's even more amazing is that some people like Derek Amato and Jason Paget, and also the woman I mentioned, the farmer, Lee Essek, actually acquired some autistic skills. They don't qualify for being autistic because they don't satisfy all the criteria, but they have acquired some of the autistic skills. So, for instance, people with autism have an extreme obsession with a particular subject matter or a particular way of attending to details that a lot of these people also have.
You mentioned Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, and said that extraordinary talent is grounded in obsession and practice to the tune of 10,000 hours. Do you agree with that?
So I don't agree with that. I would say, of course, that is one way that you can become an expert. But there are obviously many other cases, other ways that you can become very talented. And we can see these extreme cases that we can't really replicate. But when people hurt their heads, they sometimes become very talented. In the book, we also outline some algorithms and mnemonics and other methods that can be used, but not without training. But the point is that you don't need the 10,000 hours, which would be something like 2 to 3 years full time.
And ordinary people,
we ordinary people
can become quite proficient, say, in math and card counting and that.
Yeah, because, again, that's because the brain is so plastic that if you sort of give it a little bit of input of the right kinds, you can make a change. So our brains have a lot of potential, a lot of power. So it's not true that there are parts of our brains that we don't use at all, because then they would actually disappear. But it is true that we have a lot of powers and capacities that we don't develop.
Which you actually talk about in the book. We'll get to that. After this short break, we're speaking with Dr. Britt Brogard. She's written The Superhuman Mind, Free the Genius in Your Brain, and also runs the Brogard Lab for Multisensory Research. We'll be right back.
And we're back. Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and also Dr. Britt Brogard of the University of Miami of Philosophy and Psychology Department, and also the Brogard Lab, which we just spoke
about. For multisensory research.
All right. How about a phone number, Bonnie? Maybe we'll take some calls.
Yes. Are you a synesthete or a savant, perhaps? Or would you like to learn how you can be one? Or have you had an experience akin to what we're describing? Number 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Or email is radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org.
Dr. Brogard, you talk about that a lot of this becoming a savant is limiting the powers of the left side of the brain, the more utilitarian side, versus the right side, the creative side. What are some of the other ways that can be attenuated as such, so creating more geniuses?
So that is one way. We found that Jason Patchett actually had something like the opposite of that particular condition. So it seems that he has more activity when he is visualizing these mathematical formulas in the left side. It was extremely left-sided when we looked at him in the brain scan. And that was perhaps unsurprising, given that he was the main hits was on the right side of the head. There are other ways, of course, that the brain can be rearranged to develop extraordinary abilities. But usually, it involves sort of lessening the powers of the prefrontal cortex, which is a part of the brain that sits right sort of behind your nose in front of the brain. And that is the part of the brain that is involved in logical thinking and rational decision making and so on. But there are also other areas, mathematical abilities that are more sort of located on the top of the head. There are many different ways that people can strengthen their brains. Now I was just talking about the areas of the brains, of the brain, but there are lots of strategies for doing that. And we talked about one of them, which was synesthesia, which can be taught, or at least some of the beneficial effects of synesthesia can be taught.
So how do you teach that, for example? By the way, we did get an email. Al wants to know, where exactly does he hit himself in the head with a hammer?
Yeah.
Which is what we were saying, Al.
Don't try it at home.
Don't try it at home. Yeah.
Yeah, so right now, so let me mention first that some current research shows that electrical and magnetic stimulation of certain areas of the brain can also enhance people's math skills and their drawing skills. Now, that's not available yet, so this is at the research stage. But some of the things that we talk about synesthesia, for instance, is something you can actually pick up rather easily. There's one study out where all they did was they printed a book where the different letters were printed in different colors consistently. So A would always be, say, red, and B would always be, say, blue. And this over 2 weeks, the subjects actually passed some of the tests, not all of the tests, but some of the tests for synesthesia. That has not been our approach exactly. So our approach, which is still ongoing, has been to connect other things than just, say, colors and letters and numbers. So we have actually used emotions extensively to sort of make people solidify these new brain connections. So emotions are well known for for making brain connections stable. So, you
know, give us an example.
So an example is that if you experience something very traumatic, you're much more likely to remember it than if it's just sort of part of your daily routine.
Right.
And that's, this traumatic experience is an emotional experience. So for some reason, you don't have to go through the whole process of where the brain rehearses the information before it gets solidified. It just happens. So by using emotions, you can actually improve your memory, but also help develop things like synesthesia. So we have an example from one of our subjects, which is very, very simple, but of course it could be extended. So let's say you have a shopping list and you need to buy milk and you need to buy a bottle of red wine and you also need to buy some oranges. So this, of course, is a short shopping list, but you can see how you could
right.
Like, so you do several things. So you need to remember the perhaps the order. Let's say that the order is important. And so you make a route through your house. It's a kitchen, living room, terrace. And then you start in the kitchen. You're thinking about this. And there you make something that's emotional. So an absurd image would be good. So what about a waterfall of milk coming down from the ceiling? And then you go into the living room, and there you're almost sort of stepping on glass because there's this broken wine and the wine is spilled all over the place. And then you can go outside and see little oranges on the terrace with little faces and interacting with each other. And there what you're playing on is like the route and the absurdity or the danger or the funny picture. So you're actually playing on emotions. And in this case, it's to enhance memory. But you can use similar things to, for instance, learn synesthesia and increase your creativity.
What is this lucid dreaming?
Lucid dreaming is also something you can train yourself to do. Lucid dreaming is when you actually learn it, can be very convenient. Lucid dreaming involves two elements. It involves knowing that you're dreaming. So many people have experienced that. They sort of wake up in some sense of waking up. They don't really wake up, but they realize inside the dream that they're dreaming. But then in addition to that, to really be a lucid dreamer, you also need to be able to control the dream content. And that's usually the harder part. But when you can learn to do that, you can actually practice skills inside your dream while you're dreaming. So while you're resting, you can practice your skills. And there are people who become very good at it, and they can sort of try out new things using these two things, knowing they're dreaming, which is the first part. And secondly, they can then try out the new skills, and they can also get rid of, say, anxiety or phobia, or they can confront people they don't like to confront in reality. And so that's one technique. And it definitely works because you can actually, the different methods you can actually use to measure whether people have lucid dreaming or not.
In the book, you also have a mention of how fMRI testing can be used for addiction treatment. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there are many different ways that you can do that. I mean, there's something called neurofeedback. And neurofeedback is a bit different from, I mean, you could in principle use functional MRI. So that's one form of a brain scan. A simpler way would be using that kind of brain scan that where you look like an octopus. It's called EEG, and look at the activity in your brain. And the neurofeedback methods is a way of learning where in your brain the activity takes place. And
the craving for
yeah. So when right. You're craving something, right? So you have a craving, and then by getting that feedback from the brain, you can then see if you can get that activity in the brain to go down, and that can sort of feedback and reduce the craving. So that's a technique that's called neurofeedback. That's one of many different techniques for treating addiction and other negative traits that you might want to change.
I don't know if this is in your purview. Jane wants to know if you could speak about a baby who at 10 days old had spinal meningitis, insult to the brain, and if that could be the cause of Asperger syndrome or illogical thinking as an adult.
So we don't know exactly what causes autism or Asperger's syndrome. What we do know is, or we have a hypothesis that the serotonin is a neurotransmitter that is too high early on in childhood. So it's actually a neurotransmitter or brain chemical that activates the brain. But when it gets so high, it can also actually feed back and become a lot lower later on in childhood. And when that happens, it can cause brain damages to one side of the brain and increase sort of the connections in the other side of the brain, which can then give rise to increased memory or increased intelligence. Whether that particular condition could be a cause of that is not something we could possibly know.
Okay, what causes the elevated serotonin and what causes it to then diminish?
Yeah, so the elevated serotonin is presumably genetically determined. Probably it's a gene that actually expresses more of that neurotransmitter or configures the brain in such a way that the brain actually releases more serotonin. And then it's very, very common that there's sort of a negative feedback. So the brain at least normally regulates itself. So if the brain has too high levels of serotonin, then it tries to get those levels down, and then the levels become so low that can cause brain damage or trouble.
Really?
In the brain.
And so they can't be given serotonin SSRIs to replenish the serotonin?
It's interesting because there are some of the symptoms of autism that can be relieved using that approach. But there's obviously more going on. And a lot of people with autism, as opposed to Asperger's, have also a problem with speech. And so that seems to be a different mechanism. So it can't be the full story. So the serotonin hypothesis can't be the full story. Okay. But it accounts for some of the symptoms, and it might also account for some of the social behavior.
We're speaking with Dr. Britt Brogard. She's a professor of philosophy with joint appointments in the Departments of Philosophy and Psychology at U of M. And she's written with Christian Marlowe, The Superhuman Mind, Free the Genius in Your Brain. Our last break, and we'll be back and we'll take your call. Stay with us.
And 46 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Britt Brogard of the University of Miami. Quickly, a telephone call. This is Andrew in Weston. Hi there.
Oh, hi. I have a question about a course that I've heard about teaching perfect pitch. And the teacher claims to be able to get you to, when you hear a pitch, you see a color. So is this a form of synesthesia, and is this a real type of thing that you could learn?
Yeah, so let me start by saying that many people who have perfect pitch actually also have synesthesia.
That's where you go to a piano, hit a B flat, and blindly know that's a B flat.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And obviously if the B flats sort of gives you a color, right? Some color lights up in your head. Then it's not as hard to recognize it. So many people who have perfect pitch have synesthesia. So what we say in the book is it requires a lot of effort, but it seems that at least some individuals can be trained to have perfect pitch. Again, it might help to use not just colors, but also perhaps emotions or visual imagery. So we talk a little bit about that certain kinds of notes might be more recognizable if you put them in a context, not in a context when you're supposed to recognize them, but sort of in a context in, say, like we're all familiar with da 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 da, right? So you can sort of put things in a context in that way in order to pick up on notes and combine that with associations with color. So yeah, so we do describe a method. It may not work for everyone, but it is certainly possible for some people. The younger, the better, of course. But it's
Okay, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you. If B flat, for example, is a shade of blue, would B natural be another shade of blue and B sharp?
That's not usually how it works when people have synesthetes, but there might be some advantage to doing it that way. But people with synesthetes is sort of more random.
Random. Yeah.
How about olfactory responses for a synesthete? Do they have those?
Yeah. So there are people that are both olfactory and also gustatory, which is taste. So smell and taste. And there are very interesting cases. There are people who taste words. There are people who...
What a notion.
Yes. There are people who smell people. Not in the sense of smelling what they actually smell like, but they have specific smells associated with them. So those smells can be pleasant or unpleasant, and that, of course, can be both an advantage and a disadvantage.
Right.
So
maybe someone with a bad demeanor or something would somehow have a nasty taste or smell.
It doesn't always work that way, unfortunately.
It has nothing to do with like what that person's like. It's just that's what happens, right?
Yes.
Their aura, so to speak.
Why can't we recognize, why can't these superhuman powers be tapped? What's preventing us from doing it all the time? The bossy part of the brain?
Yeah, mostly the bossy part of the brain, mostly because we are focused on rational decision-making, planning, and logical thoughts, and sort of working towards a goal all the time. And there are some lower features that are processed in lower parts of the brain that are more essentially involved in, say, creative activities. So a lot of the time it's just life that demands that we use the buzzy part of the brain and not the more creative parts of the brain, because, and it's also simpler, right? Because if we are more creative, we have to do something we never did before. If we are just doing whatever we always did, it's simpler, and people are lazy sometimes.
Right.
And we'll take another caller. Fort Lauderdale, this is Ira. Hi.
Hi. I have two experiences along these lines, and then I have a question.
Okay, we're short on time. Can you be brief?
Yeah, a woman I knew was smoking 4 packs of cigarettes for 50 years. She fell down and bumped her head, woke up, forgot that she smoked. Never had another cigarette.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that's very amazing. Yes.
Okay.
And what's the other one?
My question is this. I was a court reporter for many years, so I know with a stenograph machine, I know how difficult finger dexterity is. Do these savants that get hit on the head and suddenly play the piano just sit down at the piano and they know where their hands go, or they have an increased ability to learn when somebody shows them where to put their hands?
So at least in the one case of Derek Amato, he seemed to just know where his hand would go.
He played with only 6 fingers, too.
Yeah, yeah. So he's a bit unusual in that way. But certainly it's not to say that there wasn't a brief learning period, but it was much shorter than the standard learning period. So we don't really know what it sounded like the first time he was playing, but it didn't take many months before he was touring around America and making albums.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, thanks for calling. What is this? You said that caffeine is actually like Adderall?
In some sense it is, because it's a stimulant. So it stimulates some of the receptors in the brain that makes us wired. Of course, the underlying mechanism is different for Adderall and for caffeine.
One's legal.
One is legal, yes.
And one's controlled, is what I mean.
Yeah, they're both legal, but one
is controlled.
Yeah, one is controlled. But they're both stimulants in the brain, and they work on different receptors, but they essentially do the same thing. Of course, the more caffeine you get, the more similar it is to Adderall, yes.
Okay, interesting. Do you want to take that?
We can take that. This is Jay in Boca. Hey there.
Hi there. You guys do a great job. I really enjoy the show.
Thank you.
Hi. I have a weird situation where if I run my fingers across something that's dimpled, kind of like a thimble, I get the taste and the smell of that moment right before the rain falls, or as the rain starts falling, there's a particular smell.
Right.
So is it always in response to you crossing your fingers, or is it in response to the rain starting to fall?
No, I get the smell of that time when the rain's about to fall in response to running my fingers across a dimpled surface, kind of like a thimble.
Yeah, so that definitely sounds like a rather rare form of synesthesia. I haven't heard about it before, but the way you describe it, it sounds like a form of synesthesia.
Mm. Yep. Thanks for taking my call.
I was amazed in the book,
thank you,
Britt, about that you were talking about that in many years, one may be able to put one's mind in a brain bank, so to speak, and then go on living in a virtual sense after death.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Would you want to?
I think a lot of people would probably want to if they could. It sort of depends on your criterion for identity. If you identify yourself with the minds, which is my theory that people are their minds, then if you could upload your minds and then go on living, maybe you would want to do that.
Would you?
I would do it.
Okay, Lana wants to know, I think we answered this. Maybe not. If eventually science discovers the exact locations where these changes happen, the people who had the brain accidents, that it could be surgically promoted for people with brain injuries or simply a low IQ.
It could. So.
And you even talked about stroke, it helping people with disabilities and stroke.
Yes. Of course, there's the danger of it being used in the wrong ways as well.
Right.
But as long as it's controlled, there are other things that can be used in the wrong way as well. And as long as it's controlled, it would certainly could have some benefits to people who have abilities where you could reverse them and they might get some enhanced abilities instead. So turning disabilities into enhanced abilities, perhaps.
And one last question, does it matter, is race a factor? Like, are Asians more susceptible to developing mathematical skills after an injury, is what the emailer writes?
That is a very good question. What we do know is that it doesn't look like race is a factor, but where you grew up might be a factor for other things like perfect pitch. So it turns out that there are more people who speak a tonal language who have perfect pitch, and they also will have an increased ability to learn perfect pitch. So Asians who grew up in Asia and spoke a tonal language will either have, many of them will have perfect pitch, or they will have, it'll be easier for them to learn perfect pitch. But this is not a genetic thing. It's because that's where they grew up. So if you grew up there and you spoke a tonal language, you would also have that ability. So it's
environmental.
It's environmental, and when your brain matures rather than genetic. We don't know that there are genetic differences in respect to recovering from brain injury.
How about some contact information?
Yes. I have a website for my lab, which is Brogaard Lab, so Brogaardlab, and then we have as a .com, and there's a little button there, and if you press that, you can become a research participant, particularly if you are in Miami or in surrounding areas, and my email is also on the site.
Okay. So again, that's brogaardlab.com, Brogaard lab.com. Dr. Britt Brogaard, professor of philosophy with joint appointments in the departments of philosophy and psychology at the U of M, and the author of With Christian Marlowe, The Superhuman Mind, Free the Genius in Your Brain. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we hope you enjoyed the program. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical supervision from online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads of this and other programs at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, including links, photos, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with a focus on our upcoming Labor Day and its interesting history with the executive director of the American Labor Museum in New Jersey. Also, Linda Gassenheimer and America's favorite adopted food, pizza.
Za.
Restaurateur Michael Schwartz, owner of Harry's Pizza, shares a slice with us. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.